From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Soma.
I'm from Berkeley.
Concord, Cali.
Tenderloin District.
La Mission.
The Mission District.
Noe Valley.
I live in Silver Terrace.
Coming up, we look towards the skies as we meet the country's first woman alien hunter.
Suddenly now, these tools could allow us to make observations to try and find out what the answer is, not what somebody tells us to believe.
Then we'll turn our ears from alien signals to ham radio signals.
Absolute magic. When I listen on the radio, these signals get from here to who knows where.
And we'll hear from an amateur chef with big dreams.
My first favorite dream was being in a big castle of chocolate.
We're reaching for the sky today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Today, we're going to start the show off by spacing out. No, not that kind of spacing out. There, that's better. Now fly back in your memory to the first time you saw the 1997 film Contact. You might remember this pivotal scene. Jodie Foster, playing alien-hunting astronomer Ellie Arroway, lies on her car hood with huge headphones on her ears in a field of towering white satellite dishes. She's waiting for something, a signal. She lies still, her eyes closed. And suddenly, the sounds of something, someone beyond the Earth, communicating with her. What follows is a rush of excitement as Arroway directs her team over a walkie-talkie as she rushes for the institute that hunts extraterrestrial life.
56.2 seconds! Declination left! 36 degrees! 46 minutes! 56.2 seconds!
Well, that was just a movie based on the novel Contact by Carl Sagan. But the character of Ellie Arroway was not all fictional. It was based on a real-life female astronomer, Jill Tarter. Tarter's a pioneer for American woman astronomers and the outgoing director of the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Since she was a little girl, she's been fascinated by what else or who else is out there, and she still is. She came by our studios to talk about what it is she's looking for.
At optical wavelengths, the kind of thing your eye is sensitive to, what we're looking for is very short, very bright, intense flashes of light. This would happen if someone focused a laser into a large mirror and sent a signal our direction. It doesn't appear to be something that nature can produce, these very short, less than a billionth of a second long flashes of light. But our technology in the 21st century does that with relative ease. Perhaps they're doing that to attract our attention as well. In the radio, we're looking for, again, a kind of signal that nature can't produce. But in this case, instead of looking for short features in time, we look for features that are compressed in frequency. So if you can imagine a radio dial with all kinds of different channels running up and down the dial, nature puts its output when it does radio emission. It covers many, 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 many channels. But what we're looking for is a signal that's in one channel only. Frequency compression, the kind of thing that technology can do. But again, astrophysics does not seem to be able to.
Have we heard or found either of those?
We have had false positives. We have had, we find in the radio, we find signals all the time. But they're like this radio broadcast. They're our own, yes.
We're messing up for your work.
That's right. You're a source of interference for us. But continue. It's a good cause.
So what makes us so sure that there is something out there?
I'm not sure. It's a question. And it's a question that humans have been asking all throughout recorded history. We've looked up and we've wondered whether or not we're alone. And in the past, we'd ask the priests or the philosophers or the shamans, whoever we thought was wise, and they'd tell us what we should believe. Well, in the middle of the 20th century, we suddenly had at our disposal these tools for radio astronomy that actually evolved out of the radars we developed for World War II. And suddenly now, these tools could allow us to do an experiment, could allow us to make observations to try and find out what the answer is, not what somebody tells us to believe. And so for me, that was a phenomenal transition in human history. And I got hooked with the idea that now we could really explore the cosmos, asking this old question in a scientific way and systematically try and see if we could find an answer.
So let's go back in time. As a child, were you the kid who was always looking up at the stars in the sky and wondering about artificial intelligence and aliens and Martians? And what kind of child were you?
I was the kind of kid, see, I'm pretty old. So my childhood coincided with early television. So early television programming had these Saturday morning programs with Flash Gordon.
Flash, savior of the universe.
Going around and flying from one culture to another, one civilization to another among the stars. So I think I absorbed the concept that other stars are going to be suns for other individuals. That up there, some of those stars were going to have planets around them, and some of those planets were going to be inhabited. That was my worldview, my mindset. You know, when I was a little kid, even commercials on radio, on television, had these little scientific factoids stuck into them. Like when I was 6 or 7, I learned that the sun is 93 million miles away, and it takes minutes for the sunlight to get from the star to the Earth. And I learned that from a Raisin Bran commercial.
Raisin Bran. Raisiniest bran under the sun.
That's me.
Right? I think we should be doing this thing kind of thing again. I think we should be using entertainment vehicles to help educate. And instead, we turned science and understanding how the world works into a boring list of things you've got to learn and memorize about old white dead guys, among other things, as opposed to trying to promote science by letting young people know that it's living in a mystery. It's trying to solve puzzles, answer questions that no one else has been able to answer before. It's about not having to grow up. Not having to stop asking why.
You feel like a child today?
Every day. It's one of the real benefits of having a career as a scientist. You get to learn something new almost every day. And you get to keep asking questions. Not only that, but you're encouraged to try and find the answers.
Have you, over the years, met people who haven't taken your work seriously and who would equate it to, you know, science fiction or just not take it seriously?
Oh, well, but you know, the best science fiction turns into reality after not too long. Science fiction is a way of dreaming the future.
Behind the strange signal is an alien intelligence that knows all.
Yes. When I tell people what I do, there's one of two reactions. One, they think it's fabulous. It's really interesting. Or two, they think, for whatever reasons, no chance. Doesn't exist. Not out there. Waste of time. Early on, particularly, we were continuously confused with UFOs and alien abductions and other pseudoscience nonsense. What we tell people is that if we ever make a claim that we have detected evidence of someone else's technology, we will show you some pretty incredible evidence for that claim. We will be able to provide data that are irrefutable. That is not the case with the UFO communities and the alien abduction communities.
Do you think, do you feel that, like, are you annoyed by them?
I'm not. I am always disappointed when I talk to people who are so ready to believe something marvelous and spectacular without any documentation.
But don't you want that to be true?
No, I want to know what the actual reality is. I'm a scientist. The universe can be this way or that way. It doesn't matter what I think or want or believe. It is one way or another.
On that day that the tools work and something is detected, what will change for us?
Well, it's kind of like the continuing Copernican revolution, right? Copernicus took the Earth out of the center of the solar system. And as we've pursued astronomical investigations of the cosmos, we realize that our sun isn't anywhere near the center of our galaxy. And our Milky Way galaxy is only one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe. So we are not the center of anything. And I think that continuing, if we were to find that indeed there are other intelligent species in the universe created by the same laws of chemistry and physics that led to life and intelligent life on this planet, I think that would just be another step along this path of taking us out of the center of things. And you know what? I think that would be a good thing.
Jill Tarter is the outgoing director of the SETI Institute, and we'd like to know what you think about extraterrestrial intelligence. Do you think we're alone? Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and leave us a message. And if you'd like to join the hunt for extraterrestrial intelligence, we'll show you how at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If you look out your window searching for something up there, you might see an unusually big antenna shooting into the sky from your neighbor's roof, something much too big for TV. Or maybe on the freeway, you pass an SUV bristling with antennas that isn't a police car. Chances are, if this happens, amateur radio operators are involved. Ham radio is a pastime dating back more than a century. Hobbyists, known as hams, built transmitting and receiving equipment long before radio stations like this one even went on the air. These days, a few large manufacturers make most of the amateur radio equipment sold. It's been computerized, digitized, and miniaturized over the years. And while hams count themselves among the most advanced techno geeks among us, many of the hobby's original attractions are the same as they ever were. Reporter Mike Meenan, a ham operator himself, dials us in.
What you're hearing is a dead language, at least for most official uses. It's the Morse code, a binary digital system that dates back to the mid-19th century. Among its primary users today are amateur radio operators, better known as hams. I'm one of these, and am proud to say I'm fluent in Morse. I was texting way, way before it was cool. Right now, we're listening to a conversation between an operator in Sweden and one in Georgia. Ham operators are no longer required to demonstrate proficiency in Morse to obtain an FCC license. Still, code transmission, or CW as hams call it, remains one of the most popular modes of communication. But the majority of contacts are made by voice.
Andy and Tango India.
This method of communication may seem quaint in the internet age, yet the ranks of ham operators continue to grow with more than 700,000 licensees in the United States alone. One is Christopher McIntyre of Fremont, and another is his mother, Kristen. He's an electrical engineering student at UC Berkeley, and she works for Apple. His amateur call sign, KG6SVI. Hers is K6WX. I asked these tech-savvy individuals what drew them to ham radio.
Well, I guess, one nice thing that you can't do with your phones and stuff is you can talk to people that you don't know. You can talk to, like, people in random countries all over the world, and you just can't do that with a cell phone. It's just, it's pretty different.
You're a software engineer for Apple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't this ancient technology, all this stuff? What's the point?
That may be so, but for me, it's magic. It's absolute magic. When I listen on the radio, these signals get from here to who knows where just by no infrastructure, from here to there, just bouncing, or actually more accurately, refracting through the ionosphere. I also get to make this tenuous connection with somebody on the other side of the planet. To me, there's nothing more special than that.
5 and 9, copy. Beautiful red signal, over.
And a good evening. My name is Mike, Mexico, India, Kilowatt Echo.
Here I am doing just what McIntyre described, talking to a fellow ham in Wellington, New Zealand, from my home on the peninsula. We each used radio equipment and an antenna. There were no wires connecting us. We heard each other's signals solely through ionospheric refraction. Basically, radio waves traveling thousands of miles through the atmosphere. While it's a fun hobby, there's a practical purpose, too. Every summer, there's an event called Field Day, a contest in which thousands of radio clubs set up emergency stations at parks, beaches, and other locales around the country, including the Bay Area. One of this year's sites was put together by the San Mateo Radio Club at the city's Beresford Park. I talked with spokesman Jeff Martin, W6JMZ.
What's important is we're practicing setting up our equipment to successfully make contact with one another around the country, regardless of access to electric power or telephones or internet or whatever.
Martin notes that ham operators are often called into service for backup and sometimes primary communications when conventional modern systems are disabled.
Well, actually, it's the motto of the American Radio Relay League: when all else fails. And that's the answer. The question is not if those other means of communicating will fail, but when.
Several years ago, Martin says, critical fiber optic lines were vandalized in San Carlos and the San Jose area, knocking out landlines, cell phones, internet, and even 911 service. Ham operators trained in disaster response provided emergency links, especially between hospitals in the region. Hams have also been a vital resource following Hurricane Katrina, the Indonesian tsunami, and the Japanese earthquake. On Field Day this year, the Palo Alto Amateur Radio Association, or PARA, set up its multi-mode site in just a few hours' time at Bayfront Park in Menlo Park, stringing wires and raising tall antennas with radios powered by generators.
These are our backups, you know, for security reasons, for catastrophes, disasters, anything that can happen in the Bay Area. These are the people we need to count on.
Redwood City Mayor Alicia Aguirre was impressed.
It's awesome. It's pretty amazing. Quite a network of people that are passionate about, you know, radio.
Amateur radio these days is primarily the domain of middle-aged men who picked up the hobby when they were young, before wireless devices were ubiquitous. Now, though, more women are being licensed. Kristen McIntyre, for example, is president of PARA. And kids are getting into the act, too, like 11-year-old Matthew Myers of Menlo Park, here operating one of PARA's Field Day demonstration stations under a licensed operator's supervision.
Whiskey 6, Oscar, Tango, X-ray.
For enthusiasts like Myers and for Kristen McIntyre, making wireless long-distance contact is a thrill, even in a communications era when most of us are more familiar with Skype and Twitter.
To me, it's the fickleness. It's the part that may not work that makes it special. You know, I don't know if I can talk to this person the next day or any particular day or ever again. I don't know who I'm going to talk to. That's what's exciting about it. I don't know. It's an adventure. Every time I turn on the radio, I call CQ. I don't know who I'm going to speak to. It's an incredible adventure each time.
In Menlo Park, this is November Delta 6 Mike, saying 73 for Cross Currents.
The term ham, by the way, is said to have been a pejorative that early commercial telegraphers applied to amateurs whom they considered unskilled. Radio frequencies were shared back then, long before there was an FCC to regulate them, and the commercial operators sometimes complained of interference from ham signals. The hobbyists themselves adopted the term ham, and it stuck. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Here at KALW, we're experimenting with our own way of producing radio, and it involves you.
Here.
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 Okay, together. Okay.
Here, here.
From KALW.
Recently, our Here, Here producers popped up in the 81st Avenue East Oakland Library and met another amateur, an amateur chef. Fifth grader Lita Hernandez has been dreaming of being a chef since she was 6 years old. Here's what she has to say about her experience in the kitchen so far.
My first favorite dream was being in a big castle of chocolate. My second favorite dream was eating a big cookie, and then I made more cookies, and then I ate those two until my stomach was full. My full name is Lita Hernandez, and I live in 80th Avenue in Oakland, California. One day when I was baking a bread and my cousin came, she said she wanted to be a chef. And I thought, well, if she wanted to be a chef, she's baking this, it's delicious, and what if I can make people happy too with my food? Making scrambled eggs, that was the most greatest day that I felt that I cooked, because I never thought I could have made the eggs because I got the boil popping all the stuff. But then I made it and I was very happy. Baking some pancakes. Three pancakes did not come out well. Only three, because then I got really frustrated, so I just stopped doing it. And I did four pancakes. One only came out. The other ones just, they looked like they were not good. I told my mom if I could get this cooking book. I look at it and I study what they have to do, what you have to have. I learn math because math and being a chef has to do a lot of stuff with that. I really want to do it. I want to be a chef and a pharmacist. Well, maybe I could do part-time and then another part-time, but yeah, pretty much that.
That was Oakland fifth grader Lita Hernandez. She spoke with KALW's Erica Moo at the 81st Avenue East Oakland Library. Find out more on our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can find a link to all the Hear, Hear stories from your neighbors. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Erica Moo, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Taja Lanier, Stephen Short, Isaac Silk, Anna Sterling, and Mariel Wallof. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.